Good afternoon. So last time we started by covering direct map caches. So this was our simplest to implement cache design. We divided our memory and cache into a series of fixed size blocks. And we decided that each block of memory would be assigned to one block of cache. And this meant, because our cache was smaller, that we had multiple blocks of memory mapping to each block of the cache. So we needed to do something where we could look at the cache and say, where did this block come from? So to do that, we had two pieces of metadata. So one of these was a valid bit, because when our processor starts, our cache is not going to contain any data from memory yet. So we need a way of indicating whether or not that's happened. And we also had a tag. And we learned that when we look up where a value from memory is in the cache, we're going to use parts of the address for different things. So we're going to use the lower order bits of the address to determine where in our fixed size blocks things are. And we're going to use the next bits of the address to determine which block, which row of our cache to use. And we have some bits that we haven't used. So that means that we could have addresses which differ in those bits that all go to the same block in the cache. So to disambiguate between them, we used what we called a tag, which was just we stored those bits in the cache and compared them when we were accessing things in the cache. And we talked about figuring out how addresses would be divided into tag, index, and offset. We mentioned that the reason that this worked is that we were choosing power of two sizes for our blocks, for our number of sets, that is rows. And that's why we were able to conveniently divide our address into a tag, index, and offset, which makes this cache design very efficient. Our processor doesn't need to do any complicated math in order to look something up in the cache or check if it's there. Now, we looked at how this design behaved with particular access patterns, and one thing that came up is that sometimes we'd have two addresses that happen to have the same index bits. And this actually happens in practice sort of coincidentally. So if you think of a program, you have like some variables on the stack, some variables on the heap. By just a coincidence, those two sets of variables might share the index bits. And in a direct map cache, that would be very bad, because if both of those were active, you couldn't only keep one of them in a cache at a time, and you have a lot of extra cache misses. And our solution to this is that, well, we didn't want to get rid of all the advantages of being able to relatively quickly figure out where in the cache to look, but we wanted to give more options. So we added extra, basically, columns to our cache. So we said, rather than when we take those index bits, we get to one block, we'll get to a small number of blocks, so two or more, and one of those will contain our value if we have it cached. And we call this design an n-way set associative cache, where n is the number of blocks we store per row. And each of those blocks is going to have their own valid bit and own tag, because each of them may or may not have been populated yet and will come from a different part of memory. We need a tag to tell where that is. Now, something which comes up when we have these n-way set associative caches is that, well, we could have had our value we could have had our value, you know, not be in the cache yet. In that case, we have to store it in the cache. And, well, when only one of our two ways, for example, is occupied, it's easy, right? You put it in an empty way. If all of them are empty or multiple of them are empty, well, you choose any one of those empty ways, it doesn't really matter. But our problem was that we could have a case where all our ways are full, every column has a value, and we need to decide where to put it. And that's going to be a decision we have to make, and there's multiple good options for that. And that's going to be our first topic for today. But before I move on to that, questions about things we covered last time, about direct map caches, figuring out index bits and tag bits, and offset bits. Yes?
So the cache model that we talked about so far, is that all still L1 cache?
So the question is, does this apply just to level 1 or to other levels? So the cache model we talked about so far works at any level of the cache. So the only difference is whether we're going to get addresses from the CPU or from a lower level cache.
Okay, so we haven't actually moved on to connecting the two.
We haven't explicitly done that, but the model is basically that the cache acts like the same way as memory, right? With memory, you ask to read an address or write an address. The cache provides the same interface. So you can just replace the memory a cache is talking to with another cache. Other questions? Okay. So last time we looked at our associative cache, and we mentioned, we went through this set of axes. We have our same division of address into tag, index, and offset. And sort of our notional diagram of how a cache looks is basically we have sort of what we had before for a direct map cache, but we have two copies of it. And we need some logic to figure out when we have hits. So what we're going to do is we're going to do the same test we did before for do we have a hit, which is we're going to say, does the tag match and is the valid bit set? We're going to do that for each of our columns. In this case, I only have two. Sometimes I might have more than two. And if either of those are true, we have a hit. And if we have a hit, then we're going to return a value to the processor. If we don't, we're going to have to do the work of talking to the next level or main memory. Now, we have to figure out which of the two data blocks to return. So the logic I've implemented here, which only really works for two ways, is that I say if we have a hit in the first way, in way zero here, then I'm going to select the second input to this mux, otherwise I select the first one. And that's sufficient for two ways. If we had three ways, this would get a little more complicated. But essentially, we're just looking at, that did the tag match and is it valid computation. And we know that if we're operating our cache correctly, exactly one column will match or no columns will match. Because hopefully, if we read a value and found it in the cache, we didn't decide to store it again in the cache in a different place. Yes?
So how's the valid calculated again?
The question is, how's the valid calculated again? So it's initially zero, and whenever we have a value actually stored there, it's going to be one. So in normal operation, it will start off as zero and become one and stay that way. There might be some special cases that we haven't really talked about yet where we want to clear out the cache. In that case, we do it by setting the valid bits to zero. That answer your question? So the question is, the index is the row, yes, and the offset is which value in the row we're going for. Namely, we have this data for each column. It's which part of that data we're going for, and whatever column matches. Okay. Other questions? And a reminder about how our associative lookups work is that we have sort of three possible outcomes. It could be the case that we look up something in our set associative cache and everything's invalid. That happens when booting, right, for example. It could be the case that everything's valid, but we haven't cached this particular address. We've cached other addresses that happen to have the same index bits. In that case, that's going to be a miss. Or we'll have a hit, in which case exactly one of the blocks will be valid and match the tag. There may be other valid blocks that don't match the tag, or there may not be. And so far, I've used the terminology. I've said we have our direct map caches, and we kind of generalize that to this n-way set associative cache. And you can kind of think of a direct map cache as just as a one-way set associative cache. And there's the other extreme, which is the most associative cache, which has a special name called a fully associative cache. So a fully associative cache is one set, meaning that if there's one set, that means that we have 2 to the 0 sets. So there's 0 index bits. So a fully associative cache is going to have a design where we have a valid bit and a tag and a value and another valid bit and a tag and a value and another valid bit and a tag and a value. And so on. And, you know, the cache design is going to do the, you know, check all of these tags on every access. You're not going to look up a row because there's only one row to look up. So we don't have to select the row. And we're just going to take in our address and compare the tag to each of our blocks. So this is kind of the most extremely flexible cache, and that, you know, we can store everything, every block in any place. We still are dividing up memory into blocks of some fixed size, but, you know, when we store something, it can go anywhere, and we have to check every single location to see if it matches. And I guess I should say, so we're going to check all of these, and we'll have a, like we have with our associative cache, we'll have some sort of mux where we select which one, and we use that with our offset to actually, you know, get the appropriate byte of the value. So this is just the most extremely associative cache, but has a special name, and sometimes you'll see it used. Generally, you won't see it used for memory, but we're going to use things that look like caches to store other types of information. In that case, fully associative is sometimes a good design. Yes?
What's the significance of the tag?
So question, what's the significance of the tag? So in the case of our set associative cache, we used the offset to determine where in these blocks the byte was, and we used the index to determine which row to use. But that means that, you know, when we previously accessed the value, there's multiple different values we could have accessed that would have gone to that same block. So the tag stores the other bits of the address that determined which of those multiple values we used the previous time. So in this case, for example, here, the tag is 01, and that means to access this block, I was accessing an address that started 01, our tag, and 100, the same index because it's in the fourth row, and some offset depending on whether I was getting at the 33 or the 44. So the tag lets us reconstruct where the value came from, and it's the minimum information we could provide to do that. Does that answer your question? In the case of our fully associative cache, the tag is just going to be everything and that's not the offset because we have no index bits. Other questions? Okay, so we have our idea of how our N-way set associative cache works, and these are the sorts of designs that are used by real processors. So, for example, on my desktop, in my office, these are the parameters of my caches. The L1 data cache is a 32 kilobyte cache, 8 blocks per set, and 64 blocks. Now, something we should probably go over is, what do I mean when I say 32 kilobytes? So, two things about this. So, one thing is that when we're talking about cache sizes, we're always going to be talking about powers of 2. So, this kilobyte here is 2 to the 10. And this megabyte here is 2 to the 20. It's not 1,000 or a million. It's 2 to the 10, 2 to the 20. Also, the cache size is going to be defined, this is the formulas from our textbook, as the size of each block times the number of rows times the number of blocks per row. And you might complain that, wait a moment, this doesn't include our tag bits or our valid bits. Don't we have to store those? And absolutely we do. But when we talk about cache sizes, we're only talking about the size of the data stored in the cache. We aren't talking about the size of the extra information we store for bookkeeping. And that's always true when you see someone say, our processor has a 4 meg cache. They mean 4 megs for the data. They're not telling you how much there is for bookkeeping. So with that in mind, the exercise here is, for each of these caches, take this address and divide it into tag, index, and offset. Probably the first step you want to do is figure out how many tag, index, and offset bits each of these caches will use. or at least index and offset bits. Okay, who can get me started? How should I start doing this problem? What's a good first step?
Okay.
For the L1 class, there's a 64 equal to B, where B is the offset bits.
And it says 8 blocks per set,
So it would be 8 equal to 2 to the s, and the s, small s would be the number of index space.
Okay, so let's start at the beginning. Start where you start. So you said 64 is our block size in bytes, and that is 2 to the number of block offset bits. So we determine the number of block offset bits is 6. And that's, in fact, true for all of these caches, because they all have the same block size, which isn't a coincidence. Intel decided that it would be more convenient if all the caches use the same block size. So they did that. Okay. So that's a good first step. And that's usually where I like starting, because that's going to immediately let me figure out where the offset bits of this address are. I want to do that. So you said your next step. So I guess.
Yeah, I'm trying to find the index space. We have 8 blocks per set, which is 8 equal to 2 to the small s.
S. OK, so you're trying to use this formula here. OK, so I guess this gets me to my cautionary tale about these formulas, which is that I recommend working from the sort of picture of the cache, because it's easy to get confused about what these formulas mean if you aren't careful. And you're making a very subtle mistake, which is that you want to say, oh, set. We have a set count. But this is not the number of sets. It's the number of blocks per set. The number of sets, you have to use some other information to determine that. So 8 blocks per set is this E number here. You need to do something else to get S. Yes. Okay, so your observation is that we're given C,
yeah,
and I just told you we're given E, and we're also given B, which is the 64-byte blocks. So we can solve this for S, for capital S. Yes, so that is what I would do. I have this pre-worked out, so we can solve for S and put in the formulas if you... So you could use a calculator for this, or you could note that we have 32 is 2 to the 5th times 2 to the 10 over 2 to the 6th times 2 to the 3. So we have 15 minus 9, or, yeah, 15 minus 9 is 2 to the 6th. So if you've memorized powers of 2, which I've done just by having done this stuff for a while, I can do this without a calculator. And so we have, there's 2 to the 6 sets, and that means we have 6 set index bits. Just taking log base 2 to solve for that. And the same process will work for all of the other caches. So questions on this procedure? I would say that this is not the only way of finding these values, but this is what I found most straightforward. Okay, so we can use this to find the number of block offset bits and set index bits. You may say, how many tag bits are there? Well, I didn't tell you how big the addresses were, but for the original question, that doesn't actually matter. I just told you, here's the address. I didn't tell you how many leading zeros there were, but you know that anything that's not part of the offset or index is part of the tag, and it has some number of zeros, but you can just write a value and just say there's some number of zeros before this. But we're not done here because, well, you know, I've told you how many bits there are, but we haven't figured out what the actual value of the tag index and offset is. So to do that, probably the most straightforward thing is to take our value from hexadecimal and write it out as binary. And then we can say, OK, there's 6 block offset bits. We know they're at the end of the address. So that's going to be those last 6 bits. And I just, for convenience, converted them back to hexadecimal. And then I can go through the other bits. I know the index bits are just before those offset bits. And for the L1 cache, there are 6 of them. So I can, again, write that out. It's hexadecimal after reading the binary. And everything left over is the tag for the L1 cache. questions? We did this. And we repeat the same procedure for the L2 cache. We have a much bigger index, but it's the same idea. And we have a tag leftover. And the same for the L3 cache, we have an even bigger index and a tag leftover. Some questions about any part of this exercise before we go on to our next topic? OK, so we've seen how to tag index and offset work for more realistic SOHO caches, because they're not always these like toy sizes. And let's go back to the original topic I promised you, which was replacement policies. That we mentioned our problem was that I needed to decide where I would insert some value that I know needs to go in index 0. Why does it go in index 0? Because we decided that in this address 64 here, right down here, I should draw it more carefully, we have a 0 here, and that's our index bit. So it has to go in the first row. Can't use the space in the second row. And we have to choose one of those two places to put it. Which one do we choose? So if we think of what our caches are taking advantage of, we're taking advantage of locality. And one of our types of locality was temporal locality, that our assumption was that if we access something recently, we're going to access it again. So based on that, probably the best decision to make would be that we want to take the least recently used thing that's in that first row and replace it, and not the more recently used thing, because the more recently used thing likely be accessed again more so than the least recently used thing. But to do that, we need some extra information. So the processor, needs to rather the cache needs to remember what was previously accessed, and we can do this with one bit of information for a two-way cache. And the information I'm going to choose to track, which is not the only way of doing this, is I'm going to track which block was read or written least recently. So this means that when I read the cache, I'm going to have to write to this information. So in order to keep this correctly, even if the cache isn't changing the data it has stored, I might have to update which block is least recently used when I read one of the blocks. And in this case, this is telling me that we have two ways, and I'm going to numbering them way 0 and way 1. So this is telling me way 1 is least recently used, and this would have happened because it was last accessed before the other way 0. So when we access 0, 0, we would have updated this field to 1. It would previously have been 0. And that means now when we have to bring in 64, we're going to realize, based on the bookkeeping I did, 0, 0 is more recently used than the 60 block, and the 60 block is what I'm going to replace. Some questions about sort of what bookkeeping we're doing here. Yes. We want to replace the one that was least recently accessed, which is what the bit I'm putting in the column labeled L or U is. Other questions? So by replacing the least recently accessed thing, we're hopefully, replacing the thing which is going to be least harmful, assuming temporal locality holds true, because it's least likely to be accessed again in the future, assuming we have temporal locality. Not a guarantee, but hopefully it's true. Now, a problem you might notice here is that I can do this with a two-way cache pretty easily. I just track which of the two blocks was least recently used, the other one must be most recently used. If we go to three ways or more, and we just learned that real processors go to like 16, then it's not so easy. And you might think, oh, we can just track an index of which way is least recently used. But that doesn't quite work, because once we replace that, we need to know the second least recently used way and the third least recently used way. So ultimately, we need to end up tracking the order in which the ways were accessed. And we could absolutely do this. And if you're really clever, you can do it with the ceiling of log base 2 of the number of ways factorial bits, which is acceptable. Acceptable at least sometimes. It's definitely something you can implement, but most processors, when the number of ways is pretty high, don't bother. They say that, yes, we could keep track of this information exactly, but rather than do that, they do some approximation. And you may say, so why is an approximation okay? Well, if you think about what we're trying to do, is we're making an assumption that temporal locality holds true. That's probably only an approximation anyways. Like, what the program actually does is going to be more complicated anyways. And the most important thing is that we want to make sure that if something is really recent, really actively used, we don't replace it. So the most important part of our least recently used policy is that we don't replace things which are very recently used. So a good approximation is just going to identify things that are more recently used, and if we don't distinguish precisely between two different things that haven't been recently used, then that's not a big deal. You know, even though, you know, a more precise policy would identify, oh, this one was used further back ago last than the other one. But as long as both of them haven't been used recently, we're doing great. And because of that, most processors find an approximation fine, and you can do a lot less bookkeeping and a lot less complicated bookkeeping for an approximation. In particular, a typical approximation will use like one or two extra bits for a way of the cache per set. Rather than, you know, something that scales with log base 2 of the factorial of the number of sets, of number of ways, rather. And so that's what you'll most commonly see when the number of ways is much more than 2. Now, even these approximations of least recently used, you know, it sounds kind of nice. Like, basically all we're tracking is like a bit or two saying, was this a pretty recently used way or not for each set? And that's very doable, but it still means that every time we're reading from the cache, we have to update some bookkeeping information. And some cache designers have decided that that's too expensive, that that's too complicated to implement. They don't want to implement that. So they use a simpler replacement policy. So one example of a simpler replacement policy is known as first in, first out. So rather than try to track when we're reading the blocks in each set, what we'll do is we'll just have a counter. First, we'll replace way 0, then way 1, then way 2, then way 3, until we run out, and then we'll go back to way 0. Just have a counter for each set. And this means that our bookkeeping only happens when we have to write to the cache. We don't churn operations which would normally just be reads into writes to update our bookkeeping information. So that's why this would be attractive to a cache designer, because it makes our reads a lot less complicated. The compromise, of course, is that we're going to take less good advantage of temporal locality. Now, some cache designers, and yes, there are multiple real chips which do this, have decided that, oh, you know, keeping that counter, that's awfully annoying. So why don't we just make a random choice? We'll just have a random number generator on our chip, and we'll ask it what way to use. And you might say, that seems like a pretty bad policy. But it turns out it doesn't work that badly in practice. Like, it's not as good as the other policies, but it's not really that bad. And it's hard to think of, like, why is that true? Why is it not so bad? Because sometimes we're going to get unlucky and we're going to replace something which is being very actively used. Sometimes we'll have that sort of situation where, like, I have a variable on the stack and a variable on the heap that go to the same set, and I'm going to choose to access the heap variable and replace the stack variable. And that seems very bad. If these are both like local variables, like you know i in total or size or something, in a loop. And the reason why it's not so bad is if you think about what happens afterwards. So after we replace that highly used variable, we're going to access it again. And when we access it again, most likely, it's not going to replace the thing that we just put in. And so this problem kind of corrects itself. Yes, it's going to take a little extra time, but you know, when we have those bad luck situations from a random policy or a FIFO policy where we replace something that's being actively used, well, we're going to access it again shortly and fix that problem, and most likely we're not going to have a repeat of that bad luck for a while. And so the performance actually ends up being pretty good. But the only way you can really tell is by like testing or simulating programs. So that's our variety of replacement policies. So we have our more bookkeeping, but closer to doing the best we can do about taking advantage of temporal locality at the top, and less bookkeeping, but further away from taking advantage of temporal locality at the bottom. So questions about these replacement policies? Okay, so we're all satisfied then, I guess. As I mentioned, the most common you'll see on modern sort of desktop or laptop processors is some LRU approximation. Okay, so we've talked about a whole bunch of sort of design parameters we have in caches. We have to decide how big blocks are. We have to decide how many ways and how many sets. And we have to decide what replacement policy. And when thinking about how to design a cache, we want to think about, well, if I look at a program, sort of what sort of design decisions would help this program versus not. And to do that, a common thing architects do is they look at what cache misses a program has, typically in a simulator, and they divide them into categories. And the three sort of most popular categories to divide them into are these three. So we have some misses we call compulsory or cold misses. So this is what the first time we access something, it has to be a cache miss. And it's useful to measure these, because if these are a lot of the misses your program is experiencing, then what you should think is that, you know, well, that you can't make certain changes to your cache and improve that. So since it's the first time being accessed, like changing your associativity, not going to help, right? Increasing the number of blocks, not going to help. It's the first time it's accessed. The only sorts of things which can help are making your blocks bigger, so you bring in more when you bring in a block the first time. Or doing something like prefetching, which is a strategy where you try to figure out what the program's going to access next by making guesses based on what you've seen accessed before. So if you see compulsory misses, you know that those are the sorts of things you want to do to make that lower. You can't make them lower by like fiddling with the number of sets or the number of ways. So another big category is conflict misses. So we talked about this informally. And that's basically that thing which happens like with the direct map cache, where we had, you know, so many values mapping to the same set, and we could only store a few of them. And sort of a way of formalizing this is that if you're running in a simulator, you can say, what would happen if we had a fully associative cache? And we could say any misses that would go away with a fully associative cache, where we could put, you know, every block in, you know, any of the blocks in the cache, every block of memory in any of the blocks in the cache, you know, if those misses would go away in that sort of design, we call it a conflict miss. And what we think is the cause of the miss is that we just have too many values that map to the same set, but, you know, the cache otherwise has enough space for those values. So there's some other sets which are less occupied, and we just got unlucky. We like had that stack variable and heap variable which had the same index bits, even though we weren't accessing that much data. Our last category of misses is everything left over, which we call capacity misses. So these are things where You know, the big problem is basically that our cache isn't big enough. That if we're looking at how many blocks our cache stores, like, no matter how you arrange those blocks, you're out of space to store the number of blocks the program is accessing. And what you can use this information is that if you see conflict misses, well, then you should think about maybe I can change my associativity or my replacement policy to deal with those. If you see capacity misses, well, pretty much anything you do with your replacement policy or your associativity, not going to help. You should think about how can I make my caches bigger or how can I add extra levels of cache. That's the sort of strategies you'll use to make programs that have those sorts of misses faster. And we'll look more at this a bit later after we talk about cache rights. But before I move on to that, questions about our categories of misses here? Okay, so, yes. So for conflict, adding more ways should be a solution. Now, that's not to say that if you like make your caches bigger, you'll decrease conflict misses too. So it's not to say that there aren't other things you can do, but sort of the most natural thing is that something about adding more ways or changing your replacement policy or something like that should help. Compulsory is the first time we're accessing something.
Right, so, like,
so we never accessed it before. So like loading a program.
Right, so that's just like unavoidable.
So compression is compulsory misses are unavoidable? Yes. But so they're avoidable via having bigger blocks. So if we make our blocks bigger, we'll have less time compulsory misses because the same number of misses will access more data. Yes, so like, yes, for example, so if we made our block the size of the program's data, we'd have one miss. Like, we can't actually do that, but that's the extreme. Also, there are things we can do where we guess what the program is going to access and fetch it to our cache in advance. This is called prefetching, and that's a way of avoiding compulsory misses. But if you see a high number of compulsory misses, that tells you stop fiddling around with like your cache associativity or your number of sets. That's not going to help you. Other questions? Okay, so far we've dealt with caches where we're reading values, but we also need to write values or else our programs wouldn't be very useful. And there are two big decisions that caches need to make about how they handle writes. So we're going to start with the case where our cache has a value cached, and I'm writing to that address that's cached. So in this case, the processor is writing 10 to an address that's in the cache, and it's also stored in memory. And one way the cache can handle this is known as write through. So we're always, always going to update the value that's stored in the cache. Why are we going to do that? Because if I don't do that, and I write 10, and then try to read, I better get 10. I'd be very annoyed if I wrote to a variable and then the value I wrote wasn't in that variable. So we better update our cache. But the question is, what do we do with memory? And in the write-through policy, we're also going to update memory right away. And this isn't great because memory is slower than the cache. But this avoids any complexities of doing bookkeeping we have to do for any other option. So this is the write-through option, the simplest. And this is not quite as bad as it appears, because it turns out we can often, not always, but often do the step two here kind of in parallel with other stuff the CPU is doing. So you can tell the CPU, yep, I store the value, and you know, do the write to memory in the background. We can at least sometimes do that. But it's still like less efficient than if we weren't writing to memory, which is going to be our second option, known as write back. So in write back, when the CPU writes, we're going to store it in our cache, and we're going to make a note that the value we have stored is what we'll call dirty. So dirty means that the value we have stored in our cache is different than memory. And we want to have that promise that if you read this value, you'll get the value right. So later on, if the processor reads ABCD, it better get 10. And if the value is still in our cache, well, that's just going to happen. But if we replaced that value with something else, that wouldn't happen unless we took an extra step of writing it to memory. And that's precisely what we're going to do. So in the event that the CPU asks to read something that we want to store on the same block of the cache, before we read in that new value, we're going to have to write out this dirty value. So we'll update memory so we don't forget about the value, because if we're forgetting about the value really bad, we'd have our variable that we set to 10, and later on it's FF. What, you know, that's not behavior that would be acceptable to a programmer. And only after after we write that value to memory, we can read the thing that's going to replace it. So the complexity we added here is that we have to track one extra bit of metadata, which is this, what we'll call a dirty bit, so that for every block, is it the same as memory or not? If it's not, we have this dirty bit set. And that sometimes, even if we just read a value, we're going to have to write something out to memory because we deferred writing it out earlier. But the advantage is that we'll avoid writing to memory a lot of the time. Questions about write through versus write back? Yeah?
So how does it avoid writing to memory a lot of the time? It still does it just at the same time?
So the question is, how does it avoid writing to memory a lot of the time? So if we updated, so if after I wrote 10 to ABCD, I wrote 11, I wouldn't go to memory again. And there'd still be only one write later on. So that's going to be the big savings, that if I repeatedly modify a value, it doesn't go to memory until probably after I'm done using it. Other questions? Go ahead.
Just on this example you were just talking about, so you're saying if you like repeatedly like switch the value for like ABCD, like you should have like a bunch of instructions editing it.
Yep. Question, if I have a bunch of instructions that write ABCD, it won't get written to memory until the final update? Not exactly. So if I have a bunch of instructions that write ABCD, it won't get written until memory until there's some reason to remove it from our cache. So in this example, the reason to remove it from our cache was that we read from some unrelated address, well, some mostly unrelated address that happened to map to the same set. So as long as the value stays in our cache, we won't go to memory. And if we're, you know, predicting our locality well, that shouldn't be until we're done, essentially well after we're done using it. It's not a guarantee, of course, but hopefully that would be the case. Other questions? So to implement this, we're going to add an extra column of metadata to our cache. So this dirty bit. And that's going to tell us that if we replace this block, I need to write it to memory first. We better remember to do that, or else, you know, we're going to have incorrect behavior. So that's write through versus write back. And when I started out here, I had this assumption that I was writing to a value that was stored in the cache. But that's not always going to be the case. Sometimes I'm going to have a write where the value isn't cached yet. And usually, processors are going to write less than a full cache block. So you saw on my desktop, a cache block was 64 bytes. And most of the instructions you know that write to memory write much less than 64 bytes. But our cache can only store a whole block. We don't have any way of saying, I only have half of this block loaded. So in order to put that block in cache, so if I write 8 bytes, in order to have the block that's 64 bytes containing that 8 bytes in my cache, I need to read the remaining 56 bytes. And you might not want to do that. You know, that's kind of expensive. So there's two different options that caches use to handle this case. So one is called write allocate. So in that case, we're going to say, I'm going to hope that it's going to be worth fetching those 56 bytes from memory, so I'm going to do it. So I'm going to fetch the 56 bytes we didn't write, add in the stuff we did write, so I can have the thing you wrote in the cache. And the hope is that we have good temporal locality. You're going to read or write to it again later, so this is going to be worth doing. The other option is write no allocate, that we say, if it's not in the cache already, don't go through the effort of fetching the rest of the block. Just send it to memory. You know, just say we don't have it cached. Just send it on to the next level. Let them handle it until we try to read from this data. And that would be a better option if we're guessing you aren't going to read it soon anyways, which may or may not be true. And note that this is a separate decision from write through versus write back. So we can have any combination of write through, write back with write allocate, write no allocate. So for example, if we did write allocate, write through, we'd always write it to the next level of cache. But if it wasn't already cached, we would also cache it. If we did, say, a write no allocate, write back policy, we would only store it in the cache if it was already there. We'd only update what's already in the cache if it was there. But if it wasn't there, we'd just send it to the next level. We wouldn't retrieve it. Now, most commonly, write allocate is going to be used with write back. And write no allocate is going to be used with write through, because there's kind of this assumption that, you know, if you have a write back policy, you want to store things that are being written in your cache. And if you have a write through policy, you mostly don't. But that's not required. So questions on write allocate versus write no allocate? None. So let's do an example. So here I have a write back cache, and let's say we have a write allocate policy. Now let's say I'm writing OXFF, so there's that value, into address 04. So 04 isn't in this cache. And if we look at the address 04, this is ends with 0100. And our offset bit is this 0 at the end, and our index bit is this 0. So it goes in this first block. And if we have a write allocate policy, we're going to replace whatever block we would replace. This is an LRU, least recently used cache. And the least recently used block is way 1. So this is way 1, 0. So we're going to replace this block here. So that's our first step. So that's our least recently used block. That's what we're going to replace. And this block is dirty. So before we can load the block containing 04 into there, we need to first unload this block here. And part of unloading it is writing the changed bits back to memory. So we're going to write back that old block to make it not dirty anymore. So it's not dirty. And then we're going to read in the new block. And in this case, our blocks are 2 bytes, but we only wrote 1 byte. So I need to read in the remaining byte and also store alongside it the value that the processor wrote, so the OXFF. So that's how I ended up with my value here. And it's marked as dirty because I only updated this block here. I didn't update memory. I didn't tell memory about OXFF being written there. I just stored it locally. And I also need to update my LRU information because this is an access to the cache. We'd also do this on a read to remember that now way one has a recently accessed value. We just wrote to it. So we should use way zero to replace something next time we need to do that, assuming we don't read something else first. So questions about this procedure? I'm showing you kind of our worst case, that writing a value can involve writing a different value to memory and reading a value from memory with this write back, write allocate design. Okay, so let's think about what would happen if we had a write no allocate design. So in that case, we'd try to write this to the cache. We'd say, let's see if it's in set zero. We check our tags, we'd find out it's not there. And write no allocate says, don't bother. So I just send it to memory, not update anything. And sort of our assumption if we did write no allocate is that we don't actually care about caching values that are being written if they're not also being read. Okay, so let's try a little exercise here. So here I have a cache, and let's say this cache has a write allocate write back policy, and I have three different memory accesses, and assume these are done at load. So this is not a sequence of memory accesses, just assume we start with the cache as it's shown, and we do a write to 0x33, and then we start again with the cache as it's shown without that write. We do a read from 0x52 and so on. And the question is, for which of these do we read a value from the next level? And for which of these do we write a value to the next level? And probably the first thing you want to do is figure out what the offset and index bits of these addresses are. Yes?
I have a question. If it's like more than a two-way set, your LRU is probably is going to have to be more than one bit, right?
So question, if we had a three-way set of cache, what would our LRU information look like? So it would not only be more than one bit, but it would have to be like a ordering. So we'd have to say the least recently used and the second least recently used.
Right. Okay.
Because otherwise, after we replaced the least recently used thing, we couldn't figure out what's now least recently used. Question is, each block is still 2 bytes? Yes. So for the first part of this, the writing to 0x33, who'd like some more time? A couple people? Okay. Okay, so let's do just the first problem. So writing one byte to 0x33. So who thinks that there will be a read to the next level of cache, from the next level of cache? Okay. No one. Who thinks there will be a write to the next level of cache? Okay, and who has no opinion? Okay, a few people. So the correct answer here is that there is neither a read nor a write to the next level of cache. So we have neither. And why is that? So first, I'm going to look up this value in the cache. And we have one offset bit because we have 2 bytes per block and one index bit. So our index is this one here. So I look in index one and I check, is this already stored? And it is. In fact, we have the current value of memory at 0x33 stored in the cache. So what we're going to do is we're going to modify that, and we're going to make sure the block that contains it is marked as dirty. Happily, it already is marked as dirty, so we actually don't have to do anything else. And because we have a write-back policy, we're not going to send it to memory yet. I guess I did a better job at explaining things because this morning's lecture for this question was most people thought there was a read or write. Vast majority. Okay, so questions about that? Yeah. So I looked up, so this value is already in the cache. So all I'm going to do, because I have a write back policy, is modify it in the cache. With write back, I write in the cache when I can, and don't send it to memory until I need to. And I don't need to yet because it's in the cache. And as part of writing, I need to mark it as dirty, but it's already dirty. Now, there is some other bookkeeping I need to do here. Can someone tell me what that is? Yeah. Yeah, so right now, this LRU information says the least recently used part of this set is the second one, but that's no longer going to be true after we modify it, so we're going to change this to 0 as part of doing that write. So other questions? Okay, so that's our second problem. So for the second problem, we're gonna change value in the cache plus the LRU bits, and that's it. Okay, so how about reading one byte from address 0x52? So who thinks that's going to involve reading a value from the next level of cache? Okay, who thinks that's going to involve writing a value to the next level of cache? Okay, so no one. So let's go through this process here. So again, our index bit is this one here. And we're starting, we're assuming these accesses are performed alone. So I'm starting from our original cache. And set one, index one, is that second row. So the first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to say, do we already have 0x52 stored in the cache? And the answer is no. I have 0x62 and 0x32, but not 0x52. So I'm going to need to bring it into the cache. I need to decide which of these two blocks do I replace. And we have an LRU replacement class, least recently used. And the least recently used way is 1, which is way 1 right here. So I'm going to replace this. And before I replace that, I'm going to check, is this block dirty? And it is. And because it's dirty, I'm going to have to write it back to memory, or the next level of cache at least, to make sure we don't forget about the modified versions of address 0x32 and 0x33. So we're going to have to write back 0x32 and 33 before we do any replacement. Now, yes?
So basically what you're saying is this is kind of updated 33, and you're going to like replace it because we need to use it for 52. We need to write that back to the memory, right?
The question is because we updated 33. So so the cache initially, before anything, any of these accesses is happening, those dirty bits are telling us, in the past, we updated one of 32 or 33. We don't know which ones. But they're telling us we did that because the dirty bit is set. And because of that, we have to write them both back. Yes? These aren't sequentially. This is just independently starting with that initial cache. Maybe I should reorder them in the question, but this is if they're performed alone. So if we had performed them one after the other, indeed, the LRU bit would be different, so we wouldn't replace the dirty thing. So we need to read right back 0x32333, and we also need to read 0x53, because what we're going to do is we're going to end up storing in here 0x52's value and 0x53's value in the cache. But to do that, we need to get 0x53's value, which the CPU didn't give it to us. So questions about that? Yes? So question is, are we doing this in way one? Yes, and that's because we look at the LRU bit to determine what we replace. Yes? We usually write back the old value, the 32 and 33, to the memory of the next level of cache, so it depends where this cache is. So on my system, I had an L1, an L2, and L3 cache. So the L3 cache, write back to memory. The L1 cache probably writing to L2. And the L2 probably writing to L3. Not a guarantee, but probably. Other questions? Okay, so let's think about our last access. If we're reading one byte from address 0x50, who thinks that will involve writing something, reading something from memory? Okay, who thinks that will involve writing something to memory or the next level of cache? Okay, so most people say only reading, and I agree with that. So this address has a index bit of 0, use a different color. So it uses this set 0 here. And the least recently used part of that is this way, which is not dirty. So we're going to evict that without telling memory about it, because memory already has the value. We don't need to do anything. But in order to read this byte, we have to get the bytes from memory. So we're going to read, so we're going to read, in the original case, we were at OX52. Here we're going to read OX50 through OX51 to fill in the block, which, and I have a cleaner version of this here. Questions about this exercise? Over there?
Can you explain more time when you set the dirty bit?
When do I set the dirty bit? Whenever I have a value being stored that has not been updated in memory yet. So basically, whenever I write something without telling memory about it, or at the next level about it, which we always consider memory from our perspective. Yeah. Can I go over write allocate and write no allocate? Sure. So in this case, when we wrote our byte, we don't have an example of that. So in this example of write allocate versus no allocate, so here I was writing to something that wasn't in the cache. And I had a choice of whether or not I stored it in the cache. And that choice is write allocate. So if I'm doing write allocate, I'm going to replace one of those two blocks to store it when I do the write. If I'm not, I'm not going to do that. And if I decide to store whatever value if I'm storing whatever value I'm writing in the cache, then I have a separate decision of whether I just mark the value as dirty or write it to the next level immediately. So with write allocate, if I allocate the block, well, then I'm either writing it through or writing it back. With write no allocate, if it's not already there, I'm definitely sending it through because I can't just mark it as dirty because I don't have it stored. Does that answer your question? Yes? Okay. So the question is, in the next level of cache, if the cache got a write, you need to keep the dirty bit as one. So the next level of cache need not have the same write back or write through policy. So if it is a write back cache, yes, it would mark it as dirty, assuming it was also allocating it or had it already allocated. If it was a write through cache, it would just send it to its next level. And it's not uncommon for processors to do things like have the L1 cache be write through and the L2 be write back or something like that to avoid having too many dirty values being tracked or something like that. Other questions? Okay, so that's where we'll leave off today.